Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
You're listening to Fiber Talk, that twice weekly podcast for people who make fine art with needle and thread. And speaking of fine art, what is it? The World's Most Beautiful Needlework magazine. It stops at needlework, but it's really the magazine too. Susan O'Connor, editor of Inspirations Magazine, is with us this week. Susan, welcome.
Thanks, Gary.
And I have to say, as a magazine editor, intensely jealous of the kind of magazine you get to put out. As I was having a discussion with our publisher today about downgrading the paper in both of our magazines for next year to save a few bucks.
Oh, yeah. That's, yeah.
And you get to print on that glossy cardstock. Mm-hmm. I'm so jealous.
Yes, and we always have done too. It's always been part of the ethos of the magazine that we produce a beautiful product that people appreciate, something that's crafted beautifully, especially when you're dealing with people's embroidery that they have put a lot of time and effort into. It seems only reasonable that we should meet that with an equal effort in presenting it to the public in the magazine.
So, okay, and that was what I was really curious about just as an editor, because I started subscribing, I don't know, I've got 15 or 20 issues. I'm not that long of a subscriber. And I wondered about those original issues. They all were the same treatment, huh?
Yes. I mean, the magazine has changed a lot over the years. And you can see if you look at the first issues of it, it's certainly become a lot more sophisticated and the processes have become a lot more refined, but that was always the intention, to produce a high-quality magazine with high-quality photography, with exceptional instruction, clear step-by-steps, photography where you had the actual object propped correctly so that it wasn't just something sitting against a plain background. You know, you want the images to be evocative and to inspire people. I mean, as the name of the magazine suggests, Inspirations, you're trying to inspire people to want to actually do something, and all of those things assist in that process.
How many years have you been editor?
I've been editor since issue 82, so probably about, what are we up to now? We're currently working on issue 102, so about 5 years. I've been involved with the magazine from the very first issue.
Oh, so you have all the history.
I do. I do. If you open up the first issue of Inspirations, mine is the first project.
Oh, there we
that's
go.
That's pretty great.
Oh, that's tremendous. So, wow, that's great to be from issue one of a magazine like this. Oh, so you were, what was that year? What year was that?
That was the first issue came out in September in 1993.
Okay.
And that was the first proper magazine issue. There were actually three smaller issues of the magazine that were add-ons to another magazine called Australian Smocking and Embroidery. And the original intention of Inspirations magazine was to carry the embroidery projects that wouldn't fit into that other magazine into their own magazine. So in order to test the water, there were three, I think there were only about 12 pages, sort of like a mini magazine, mm-hmm. that were put onto the back of, the first one was on issue 22 of Australian Smocking and Embroidery. And it was just to see how much interest there actually was in a magazine that was devoted exclusively to embroidery. So, and that was in, as I said, that the first one of those was in, on the back of issue 22 of AS&E, as we call it, and that was in 1992 that happened. But the actual magazine, the first issue of the magazine, came out September 1993.
And the other one doesn't exist anymore?
No, the other one doesn't exist anymore. The last copy of that came out in 2012, that magazine, and actually that was issue 100 of that we finished with.
Oh. That's a rare thing to start an offshoot and have it actually become the main.
The child surpassing the parent. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's tremendous. So that did that. And I'm sorry, I just have to learn about the history of these magazines because it's what I do all day. Did that magazine, was it basically just in Australia? How did that evolve to become such an international publication?
Are you talking? You're talking about Inspirations?
Yes, Inspirations. Yes.
Well, no, because Australian Smocking and Embroidery had become an international magazine. It had people. We had subscribers all over the world for that. So, Inspirations was straight away introduced to an international audience.
Oh, wow! Nice.
It was because it was piggybacked off AS&E. So people who were getting AS&E, no matter where they lived, were finding out about Inspirations as well. And I think at the moment we have subscribers in about 50 countries around the world.
Yeah, I was impressed in the 100th issue, the list of people who, what was it, what do you call that?
Oh, the foundation members.
Yeah, that have all the issues.
All the issues, yeah.
What a collection.
And there's a lot of people too who have collections of all the issues of AS&E, which is an even more difficult thing because I think the first issue of that was published, there were only something like 1,000 copies of it.
Mm.
So to have an issue one of that is pretty rare.
Yes, yes. So in terms of publishing, then you've been through, I assume the photography was film. Still quite film to start?
Originally, yes. Yes, it was film. And we had the same photographer up until 2015, a guy called Andrew Dunbar, who was an exceptional photographer, an award-winning photographer as well. And he unfortunately died in September in 2015. And we lost Andrew, which was, I think we're still getting over. But we now have other exceptional photographers, but Andrew did an amazing job, and because he'd been doing it for such a long time, and he was a very intuitive person. I think we could have just given the products to him, and he could have done the photography by himself without any help from anybody. But that's another thing that's always been, I think, a hallmark of the magazine is the quality of the photography.
Oh, without a doubt,
makes a difference. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. It does make a difference because I can remember years ago when I used to go over to the US. I belonged to an organization called SAGA, which is the Smocking Arts Guild of America, and I'd go over to their national convention and people would say, oh, you know, the children are so beautiful in Australia. And it's like, you know, the children are no more beautiful in Australia. It's just the way they're photographed. we don't have exceptionally beautiful children here. We just have an exceptionally good photographer who knows how to get the best out of them.
Yeah, and that's that photography part. See, I've worked on two magazines in my career where we had a photography budget because I do trade magazines, so virtually all of our photography is contributed from manufacturers and vendors and things. And so I have a little taste of what it's like to shoot to do a cover shoot, for instance, with a photographer and stage something. And at the level you do it throughout the entire magazine, that has to be half or more of the work of putting together any issue.
Oh, you might be surprised at how good we
really?
Are at it.
Oh.
The photography, just the general photography, the heroes and the probably done in about 2 or 3 days.
Really?
And then there's the close-up photography. That's a separate thing. That usually takes 3 or 4 hours. And then the step-by-step photography, depending on how many step-by-steps there are to be photographed, that can quite take a bit of time as well. But, no, it's not a huge amount of time in the magazine. It's an exceptionally important part of the magazine. But no, I think we've been doing it now for so long, we it's not formulaic, but we know what we are looking for and how to get what we want.
Yeah. That surprises me. I could just see entire week or more setting these things up and figuring out what you're going to shoot. And
No, it's not. We have pre-production meetings where we look at the products that are going to be photographed and discuss ideas for ways of presenting them. But the actual photography itself is usually maybe 3 or 4 products done in a day.
Oh.
So it's only, I think the last lot only took 2 days to do. So.
Oh, my.
That's pretty quick.
Yeah, it is.
I'm really surprised. I really am.
It has to be, though. I mean, you would be aware of the cost of photographers, and you know, we need to, in order to be able to bring this magazine out and to make it a viable product, the things like photography need to be efficient, because we don't have endless photography budgets, and we can't spend, you know, huge amounts on photography, because the magazine just wouldn't exist if that was the case.
Yeah. Yeah, and you said you're working on issue 102, and 100 just came out, and folks, you have to work that far ahead, and I'm sure that things are already in the works for 3 and 4 too.
Yes, I've just actually been setting up projects for issue 105. So
yeah,
we do work way ahead.
Yes, yeah.
Although it frightens me when I write 2020 onto things, it just freaks me out.
yeah, and that's the phenomenon that we talk about all the time, is how quickly the year goes by, because you know your whole life is a cycle of an issue, and
and when you're working a schedule, and you know you're working on scheduling 10 issues, and you look at that last issue and you think, wow, I'm never going to get there. Next minute,
there.
It's there, yeah. It was a bit like that with issue 100, when I was scheduling that, and I was thinking, wow, this is a long time off, and now it's been and gone.
Yes. Yeah, all the build-up, and it's over, yes. Yeah. The few issues that I own, and over 100 issues, the number of stitchers, designers, and the caliber you've been able to deal with over the years is just kind of mind-blowing. I mean, you've really had the cream of the crop from all over the world.
Yes, we've been really lucky in that respect. And it's actually been interesting, because I was listening the other day to your podcast with Trish Burr.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've watched Trish develop as an embroiderer from her very, very first project that was with Inspirations to what she does now. And it's amazing how people, you know, you look at their work first off and you think, oh, that's really great. But it's amazing how much better they get over the years.
Yes. Yeah, I can imagine that. Yep. And you look at what Trish delivers now. And so.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So who have been some of your favorites?
Oh, you're not supposed to have favorites.
Oh, yeah, that's right. All right.
Having favorite children, isn't it?
Yeah, kind of.
Well, I guess that it would depend on what you think would make them a favorite. Like some people produce exceptional information.
Mm-hmm.
And when we sit down to actually write the magazine, people who produce exceptional information very quickly become favorites.
Yes.
Because, you know, you don't have to go off searching for what thread was that and how many strands did they use and how many wraps did they put on that bullion knot. You know, that can make somebody a favorite. But
yeah, and that's really true. My senior editor and I were having a discussion about that this morning, about a couple of PR people who don't know rule number one, which is if you make life easy for editors, you get coverage. And and you make them work and you get shoved to the back of the row. Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, there's also people who just produce exceptionally beautiful embroidery. And I guess, favorites, I guess. You know, I've always loved the work. Jane Nicholas's work is amazing. Mm-hmm. Her the precision with which she does things, and her concepts are amazing. Margaret Light, is another one who I've always loved Marg's work. She actually hasn't had anything in the magazine for quite a while, but she's had some beautiful projects in the magazine. Betsy Morgan. I love Betsy's stuff, even though I'm not a counted thread stitcher at all. I like Betsy's. I love her aesthetic, the colours that she uses, and the her subject matter. Julie Kneedle is another one who it's her project that's on the front cover of issue 100, the Mistletoe Bell. But she, unfortunately, Julie died in last year very, very suddenly. So we do actually have, we've just sent off to print a book on her work. It's called Botanica, the three-dimensional embroidery of Julie Kneedle, which is a really, really beautiful book as well. Mm. So can't actually wait for that to come out. The F&Gs came the other day, and it looks, even without it being bound, it looks really, really great. So that's going to be a really, really beautiful book. Other favourites. Gosh, it's hard to pick people. Hazel Blomkamp.
Hazel's
stuff is just amazing.
She stops me every time, yes.
She's just the greatest person. You know, she's such fun.
Yes,
and her embroidery is just like I just look at it and I think, oh my goodness, Hazel, what are you thinking? What are you thinking? It's just amazing. The intricacy and the amount of detail that she puts into things is just really, really exceptional.
Yeah.
So, but everything has its little appealing parts, right. You know, it's really hard to pick things out, but I guess those people that I've named are people who've had a lot of projects in the magazine as well. You know, they've been consistent contributors over the years.
That's what I was trying to picture in my mind and was so anxious to talk to you is that whole process of designers submitting. Do they get invited? Do they submit? Is it both? Yeah. How does that work?
It's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of both. If I'm sitting down to work on upcoming issues, I'll contact people and say, you know, we'd really love you to do a project for this issue. This is the time frame. This is the deadline. Are you interested? Most people come back and say, yeah, I'd love to do something. Some people say, no, I don't have time at the moment, but, you know, I'll think about it for another issue. So we sometimes then put it in a little bit further ahead. It's really a mixture of things. And we're always looking for people. We're always looking for new projects, for new techniques, for new ways of using stitch. So, but it is a bit of both.
Now, do people normally, if you say, all right, you invite somebody, then they submit a design with a stitched model, or how do you work that out? Do you have them?
If it's somebody who's unknown to us, we would usually ask them to submit photographs initially. Mm-hmm. And then if by looking at the photographs we determine that that's perhaps something that we would like to have in the magazine, then we would ask for the actual stitch model to be submitted.
And then when they submit that, then, of course, they're supposed to submit all detailed instructions and lists of
threads. Yes, we would normally send some guidelines. We send contributor guidelines to people who've never put anything into the magazine before, just so that they've got some understanding of what our expectations are. Because, yes, ideally we would have, you know, full documentation of all the threads that are used, the stitches that are used, the number of strands that are used. You know, all of that stuff, really, mainly because that makes our job much easier, because sitting down and writing becomes an easy process where you're just referencing somebody's notes, which is not always the case. Sometimes it's, you know, you're lucky, you might get a scrap of paper with something scribbled on it. just work the rest of that out. It was actually when we were working on Julie Kneedle's book, she'd done notes for some of the projects, but there were three or four of the projects we actually had no notes on at all.
Mm.
So we really just had to work it out. And luckily we were familiar enough with her methods of working that we were able to do that without too much trouble.
Oh, that's a challenge. Oh.
Yeah, it is. And the things that are really frustrating is when someone does give you information, but they omit three or four threads. It's like someone who gives you a recipe and they leave out an ingredient.
Right.
So the thing never ever works out properly. It's that, when you get to a point well into the writing process where you've thought, okay, I'm okay here, I can put my alphabet in, so I've got my key, and then you get towards the end of writing up the project and you discover that there's maybe two threads that you didn't have listed, and then you have to go back and you have to redo your alphabet, and then you have to go through all your writing and you have to change all of your all your letters because your alphabet has been changed. That can happen like three or four times in a process, which is
that's a bad day at the office right there.
It is a bad day at the office.
Yeah.
Bad words spoken.
Yes. Without a doubt. So, and then do you stitch a model? I mean, you got to write these instructions.
We don't
do that at all then.
No, we don't have time to do that. We do the step by steps, which is, and actually Elaine, who is my assistant editor, she does an exceptional job of those step by steps. She takes all that home. She nuts it all out. Sometimes it's easy. Sometimes it's a little bit more challenging. And often the techniques are very, very new to her.
Yes.
But she is particularly careful and precise in the things she does, and she really produces exceptional work in that regard.
Well, and that's that's why I was curious about that, because a lot of this stuff is rather sophisticated and high end stitching. So it. If it's not right, plus if you haven't done it before, there's that learning curve just so you can write about it.
Yes, and then there's always the added dilemma of things not always, you can go to reference books, but you can't always guarantee. It's a little bit like going to Google. You can't always guarantee that the information you're getting is correct. Mm-hmm. You might have two books and have exactly the same technique shown in two completely different ways. So there's also that you have to work around.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of it.
Yeah, folks, it looks easy, but simply not. So have you always had kits? Have you always offered kits?
Pretty much. We have. I'm just trying to think when, because I know there were not always kits for the ASNE projects, but there were towards the end. But I think pretty much so with Inspirations, because I think by the time Inspirations came out, there were kits being done for Australian smocking and embroidery, so it was just a continuation of that.
Yeah.
So,
because that's a whole other aspect of the business, in that you have to store threads and materials and all kinds of things to deliver the kits. That's a whole warehousing thing there.
Yeah, but I think we've got it down to a point now where, it's always difficult to determine how well something is going to sell as a kit. That's always a little bit of a toss-up, but I think we've got it pretty much down to determining fairly closely the amount of material that's required, because as you say, the last thing you want is to have a huge amount of excess material for a kit that's not selling.
Right.
Like, what do you do with it? It's
yes.
that can be a huge problem, but I think it's pretty well managed at the moment. So, and often the kits sell out really quickly and then they have to be redone. The other problem with that is actually sourcing materials. It's becoming more and more difficult to actually get the products in good time. Like, they're available, but it's like, oh, that's going to be 3 months, or just even more difficult, I think, in Australia, because we're such a long way from other places. Often the wholesalers won't put in an order unless they've got an adequate amount, or they only do it every 3 months, and if you need something relatively quickly, because not so much the original lot of kits, but when they have to be re-kitted, and you need to get the stuff really quickly because the actual first lot of kits, as I said, we're working on 102 at the moment. Well, Sue, who's our kit manager, she's doing all the sourcing for that now and the ordering for that now. So by the time that magazine comes out, those kits will be ready to go. Mm-hmm. But if you then need to make another sort of 40 kits and you need the stuff quickly, that becomes very, very problematic.
Okay, I can see the frustration there, yes. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, we misjudged this one, and now we got a whole rack of orders. And
yes, and it's so hard sometimes, you know. You think, oh, well, that might, you know, might sell a reasonable amount, and then it just blows out of the water. It's just amazing.
Well, and you get such original and creative designs that and the way you present them, yeah, I'm sure that they literally, you know, I hate to use the word, but inspire people. Mm-hmm. And get them all excited. You see an issue and they just start ordering. And
yes, yeah. And it seems to be regardless of the cost too, often. You know, things that, because some kits are really quite expensive. You know, once you start adding in lots and lots of skeins of reasonably expensive thread, it adds up very, very quickly.
Yes.
So, yeah. But that doesn't seem to be a barrier to a lot of people. So, and I mean, too, the having someone going out and collecting it all up for you, I think is a fairly priceless thing.
Oh, sure, sure. Well, here in the States, we're experiencing that more and more, where people don't have a store. So
yes,
you've
got to be able to find it before you can buy it.
Right, and I know in Europe, it's even worse than that. So. Somebody's going to ship you a box with everything you need. Yeah, you just order it, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Gee. What fun. I just love the hearing about how this all gets put together. And then you have the other thing I enjoy about the magazine is you have articles about artists, different artists. I really enjoy reading those. Please
yeah,
don't stop.
I really like those bits, yeah. And it's an interesting part of the magazine because we're able to introduce to our readers people who may not necessarily be doing things that you would put into the magazine, but they're mm-hmm. things that are, from a needlework perspective, are so interesting and so so inspiring and occasionally, like, just mind-blowing stuff.
Yes. Yeah, no, that to me, that's the real fun. You guys really take us into some new dimensions and people who are, who are just out in left field somewhere. And it's so much fun to read about, like this in the 100th issue that, was it Danielle Clough? Or...
Oh, yes. Yeah, Danielle Clough, yeah, from South Africa. Yeah. Her work is just amazing, isn't it? It's fantastic.
Stitching on a tennis racket. I love it.
Yeah, pretty great.
Yeah, but her whole approach to stitching is just phenomenal. It's just, I love it. It's great.
Yeah. Well, and that's what's so fun is you run into people like that who don't sit down and look at a conventional design or whatever, just out of their head falls these things. And you know, how do you even conceive that and then convert it to thread? It's so much fun to see, like some of those portraits, you know, they're just incredible.
Yeah. And I think too, for a lot of people who perhaps have come up through a fairly conservative line with embroidery, seeing work of somebody like Danielle, it's really liberating. You can mm-hmm. look at that and go, wow, look at that person's doing with a needle and thread. You know, I don't have to stick to my 32 count linen and I don't have to use this thread with that. I can, you know, really, Danielle is one of those people who says, you know, you can do whatever you want to do. Mm-hmm. And they're the sort of front page articles that I think our readers, even though a lot of them may never ever do embroidery like that, it's incredibly inspiring and incredibly liberating to see someone doing something like that.
Oh yeah. And I look at it with some of these, and you look at, you know, for just because it's easy example, what I'm doing, and then I look at some of those things and, oh, maybe I could modify it gets my wheels spinning about, could I take this little bit here and do it in a different way? Yes, exactly. It gets you thinking. And
yeah, absolutely. And it shows you, you know, the potential for embroidery, that it's not, you know, it doesn't just have to be on a bit of fabric. It can be on a tennis racket or a, you know, a fence or
a piece of wood.
Yeah, yeah.
Tennis racket, I love it. And an old one, an old style tennis racket.
Yeah, those
too.
Great old timber tennis rackets, yeah.
That's just great, yeah. And I really do, I enjoy those articles. Do you just have those contributed by writers, or do you seek them out?
We have a really exceptional writer, Ancy Vanderwalt, does a lot of them. Ancy is an Australian, or she's South African by birth, but she's currently living in Dubai, and she writes a lot of those for us. And we also have another girl called Anne-Laurie Camilleri. She's French, and she's a photojournalist. She also contributes quite a number of stories to us. And sometimes they're just things that we have chased up ourselves. A few years ago, we had a couple of really great articles from Michelle Carraher, who's the did all the costumes for Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. we just contacted Michelle, and she was very, very happy to send us images and tell us about how she goes about doing that work. So it's really a combination of things. It just depends where there's interesting stories, you know. You grab them wherever you can.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. And then you have so much fun. I always look forward to Friday with the newsletter.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, that that just strikes me as incredibly popular.
It is. It's become very, very popular. Yeah, I actually get to proof that the week before, so I get to pre-read it.
That's my Friday morning highlight when that shows up. I just work stops and feet go up on the desk, and I'm just going to enjoy that.
Read all stitched up, yeah.
Yep. No, that's just great. No, and you always have some kind of a theme, and it's just anybody who's listening and isn't subscribing to that, it's free. Subscribe to it, because it will give you every Friday in the States anyway. It'll give you inspiration. Really, some great stuff in there.
Yeah, it's a great way of bringing people together too. I think it's and it gives people a voice. You know, someone writes in and says, "I'm going somewhere and I need to know where there are embroidery stores." It gives people who are out there a voice to come in and say, you know, I know this great shop somewhere. Why don't you go and visit that? Or, you know, there's been quite a, in some of them, there's been a few offers of, you know, come and visit me. I live there. So it's a great way of bringing people together.
Right, right. And then your books. Now, you mentioned that you're doing, now I've forgotten the name of the artist that's on the cover.
Oh, Julie Kneedle.
And then I tried for some time and finally did get a copy of the Passion for Needlework. Those books, you've got quite a lineup of books. How many of those are you publishing, and how many others are you basically distributing?
There's the second Passion for Needlework's just been released. That's the Factoria 7 one. So
that's number
two.
Okay. I wondered about that.
So the original one came out a couple of years ago, but it's also now been re-released as a deluxe edition with a hard cover, mm-hmm. so that it's the same presentation as the new one. Just think what other books.
So Factoria 7 then is Passion for Needlework number two.
It is, yes. Factoria 7 is the name of the building in which it was photographed.
Oh.
So that's where that come. Have you seen that book yet?
No, Gary? No. I just saw it on your website, and
yeah,
so it just released.
It was released. It was released at Beating Around the Bush, which is our needlework convention we've just had. So, and it's, I think you'll be quite amazed by it. I think it's just another step up
okay.
in the presentation of
if that's possible.
Needlework. Yeah. Well, yeah. We thought the first one was pretty good, but this one's just a whole other thing. And then, of course, we've got the botanical book as well, which is a beautiful book.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Factoria, can we get that through Amazon and our usual channels now, or still just from you?
Yeah, no, you can get it through Woolly Thread in Washington.
Okay.
I'm not sure whether you can get it through Amazon. It always breaks my heart when I see things on Amazon. Just a little bit.
Yeah, it's a reality I don't think we're ever going to get rid of now.
Yeah, I know, but I think it's like a, as far as books go, it's like a monster that eats itself.
Yeah, truth to that, but it's there. It's part of our lives anymore, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, but so. I guess, you know, it's there, but you don't have to use it. I always think, you know, whenever you buy anything, there's a price and then there's a price.
Yes, that's true. Well, the passion for needlework, I'll never forget, because my kids said, what do you want for Christmas? And I said, this book. And it was that pause, like, really? I want this book. And then
it's better because in the past you used to ask them for buckets of aquarium salt. So this,
right.
I think, is a step up.
Right. Right. But then they couldn't get it.
Oh.
Because it was sold out completely.
Okay.
And you had a long delay there before we were able to get it.
Yeah.
At all.
Well, I mean, you can always order stuff from Australia. I mean, and the reality at the moment is because the Australian dollar is relatively low to the US one, sometimes it actually works out cheaper to do it that way.
Oh, does it? Now, see, I thought you didn't
same
have
with subscriptions.
Any.
Yeah. Well, it may have been out of print for a little while. I don't actually remember, but yeah.
But, and then finally I was able to get it, and I've looked at that thing 100 times. That's a good one.
Oh, well, just wait till you see the next one.
As soon as we're done, I'm ordering it. It's not a wait till
yeah,
I see
it.
I'm ordering it.
And it's a hardcover book, so it's a real book. Yeah.
So Woolly Thread is where I go. Okay.
You can get it through Woolly Thread.
Because you've gilded me right out of Amazon, so I guess I'll have to.
good.
All right, I'll call Woolly Thread. I'll get it.
Yeah. Yes.
So yeah, and so then the botanical book. Then when was it? When does that come out?
That will come out in early next year, so probably February or March, I think. That's a very different looking book. It's got a very it's all been shot on just a dark background, so really to highlight the embroidery.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a different approach, but it's come out really well. Really like it.
Now, is that a whole the books a whole different division for you, or is that part of the editorial staff job too?
No, that's part of my job. I think you might be a little bit surprised at how small our team is. There's not many of us, so we all have to multitask.
Well, we do 24 issues a year with 5 people, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know about small staffs, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so Elaine is assistant editor, but she also does all the step-by-steps. I also do all the diagrams in the magazine, so that's part of my job as well. So yeah, we have to wear many hats.
Yeah, diagrams, illustrator,
hand, colored pencils.
No.
Yes.
Okay. I just genuflected. Wow. I'm impressed. Okay.
No, they're all done by hand, and which I really think it adds a nice little element to the magazine.
I agree.
Having those there, you know, things like Illustrator are great, but there's a certain coldness and sterility, I think, to that sort of images that are generated in that way. I like the imperfection of things that are hand drawn.
Wow. Okay. I'm impressed.
Sometimes some magazines, there's not a lot of diags. Sometimes there's a lot of diags. And actually in the last couple of production quarters, the last quarter we did a magazine and the botanical book. And then the quarter before that, we did the magazine, Passion for Needlework, Factoria 7, and the index in the time that we would normally just do a magazine. So,
Those are some long days.
Yeah.
Oh, man. It seems warped, but what fun. What fun to put that stuff together, though.
Well, it is. And it's really easy, I think, sometimes to complain about things, but you have to stop and think about how lucky you are to work doing something that you love, that utilizes the skill set that you have, and, you know, just really brings a lot of pleasure to us doing it, and hopefully to the people who then read the end product. And we are really, like, as I said, we're a small team, but we're a really cohesive team, and we work really well together, and it's a really enjoyable place to work. I love going to work.
Well, and you have a product that people are just itching to get their hands on every time one's due out.
That's good to hear. Well, it's good to know that.
Because, I mean, I see it on the Facebook groups. Did you get your inspirations? No, I have mine. And, yes.
And then people start ringing us up or emailing going, I haven't got my magazine. I just think it's so nice in this day and age where there's so much pandering to the lowest common denominator to be able to produce something that, you know, doesn't do that. That's something where you're aspiring to being the best at something rather than being the worst at something, which I think so many other things do. You know, you only have to turn on the television and it's like, you know, who are they making these programs for? Because I'm sure it's not me.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's just it. You're able to produce the cream of the crop with all the trimmings, and it really is got to be incredibly rewarding each time one comes out. What a plus.
Yes, and it's always amazing, you know, when you get those first issues that come through, that it always looks different. You know, you've seen it on the screen so many times and you've seen it printed out so many times, but the actual completed bound magazine is always that little bit of excitement about seeing it for the first time when it comes from the printers, when you get the advanced copies from the printer.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody on the staff stitch?
No, not everybody on the staff stitches. Probably actually Elaine and I would be probably the only ones who stitch.
Hmm.
But that's okay because we're the only ones who probably, it's important that we stitch, so.
Would have thought everybody'd catch the bug after a while.
Yeah.
Well, you know, some people there pretend that they can stitch, but.
No, I just could see lunch hour, all the needles come out and.
No.
Oh, that kind of wrecks my little idyllic.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah.
Wind went out of my sails right there. Darn it. And then beating around the bush. Now that.
Yes.
I get the impression that that's a significant event.
It is. We've just had the 10th one. And yeah, it's a great event. I mean, we have people come from all over the world and it's a week of classes and, you know, having fun, getting together, stitching, eating, drinking, talking, doing all of that sort of stuff. Yeah, no, it was great. We had a great time.
Now, is it always held in Australia there, and
yes, it's always held in Adelaide, or it wasn't originally, the first couple weren't held in Adelaide, but it is in Adelaide now, because that's where we are, that's where the business is, so that's the logical place to do it.
And it's people sign up to do projects and learn from individual teachers and classes.
Yes, we have. There's a 1 day class, a 2 day class, and a 3 day class that each tutor offers. So, and people can just choose from whatever they like. They can do classes all with one person, or they can do a 1 day class with one person, a 2 day class with somebody different, and a 3 day class with somebody different. So, or you can just do a 1 day, come and do a 1 day class. So there's no obligation on anybody to be set into having to do 6 days of classes.
Mm-hmm.
Some local people just come and do one class. People who fly in usually do all 6 days of classes. And we have a quiz night, which Hazel Blomkamp is always the quiz master, and which is lots and lots of fun. We have a gala dinner, and there's lots of little tours and things that people can go off on. So no, it's a lot of fun.
So if you come for the week, you really get a full treatment there then.
Yeah, and it's held at a school that has boarding facilities. It's a private school.
Mm.
And so a lot of people actually come and stay on campus. So, they don't have to travel to and from classes. They just have to get up in the morning and get ready and wander to class. So, which is a fun thing to do. I've done that a couple of other things, and it's a great way to become immersed into something and forget that the rest of the world exists.
Nothing wrong with that.
No, it's a fun thing to do.
Is needlework growing in Australia?
I don't know that it's growing at the moment. It's a bit like South Africa. We've always had a really active needlework community, which I've got no idea why that is, but there's still a lot of people who do needlework. But I don't know that I would say that it's growing. It's sort of become one of those things that, if you're ever out somewhere and you're sitting on a plane doing your stitching, people sort of look at you like you've got two heads. It's become this really sort of strange phenomenon that I guess because people aren't used to seeing.
Try it from my perspective.
In this day and age, someone actually sitting and creating something with, doing something with their hands that isn't sending a text message.
Yeah, that's true here too.
Actually using a needle and thread or knitting needles or a crochet hook to actually sit there and create something. I think people are quite fascinated by that when they see that.
Yeah, I think so. The last time I was in Germany, I was doing needlepoint on a lap stand all the way back, 10-hour flight. And the lady next to me was watching a movie, but I could feel her eyes on me.
Yeah, she was. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. People are fascinated by it. It's just, and I think that fascination comes from now that, it used to be that things like needlework were taught in schools. Well, that's no longer the case. So the exposure of the majority of the community to things like that is now really, really limited.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be, or you'd see your mother knitting or your mother doing embroidery, but nowadays that's a very rare occurrence for people. So they're quite fascinated by seeing something that they've probably never, ever seen before.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, that lady, it took 2 hours, and finally she just leaned over. She says, what is this that you're doing? And she didn't want to intrude on me. And I would have talked to her for 2 hours. I mean, we were going to be next to each other for 10, so I had time to kill. She was trying not to be intrusive, but I could tell it was not something that she related to at all. And, I'll talk to you about it all day long.
It's interesting though that even people who probably don't have any interest in it are really fascinated by it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to the point where someone who would probably not normally talk to you on an aeroplane would strike up a conversation and say, you know, what are you doing?
Yeah, very true. So what kind
of stitches? Probably really want to say, why are you doing it?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Question two, what's wrong with you? Yeah.
Yeah.
What kind of, what stitching do you do? Mainly embroidery?
Well, very little now because I really don't have a lot of time to do anything. But I also like to paint. My background's in fine arts. It's not in domestic arts at all. So, I like to do some embroidery when I get some time. But unfortunately, that's not that often.
Yeah. Know that feeling, yeah. As an editor, do you travel quite a bit to events?
No, not really. I go to the US 2 or 3 times a year, but that's one of those is to teach. But no, I don't. I'm pretty much ensconced in Adelaide, and that's where I stay.
I'm jealous.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind going to Australia 2 or 3 times a year.
Well, you know, it's just as far from here to the US as it is. For some reason, people sort of think that maybe it's twice as long, but it's not.
Yeah, it's on my list. I'm not an overseas traveler, but Australia is on my list. Mm-hmm. I do that one.
Well, we're here. The door's open.
Yep. So 100 issues, and you already have, obviously, you're 4 down the road from that. So unlike the previous magazine, it's not stopping at 100.
No, definitely not stopping at 100.
Pondering. No, often.
That's great. Well, Susan, sure have appreciated your time and hearing about all this. I know people, at least people I know, love the magazine and hope we can give them a little insight into what goes on behind the scenes and what goes into putting that thing out, because it's a beautiful publication.
Well, thank you, Gary. I appreciate that. And, you know, that's our aim, is to produce something that's beautiful and that people are going to like and they're going to love and they're going to keep forever. My mother actually, she said, you know, I need to stop my subscription to the magazine. And I said, why? She said, well, I just don't have anywhere to put them anymore. So a few years ago, we put out a survey, and one of the questions was to people, how long do you keep your inspirations? And we didn't get one response that suggested that somebody actually ever threw one out. So
I couldn't imagine doing that. No, not a chance.
Not a surprise.
No. No. Well, really have enjoyed it. Susan, thank you for the time. And
thank you, Gary and Christine. It's been great to talk to you. And I expect to see you in Australia at some time very soon.
Okay, it's on the list.
I'd love to do that.
The next beating around the bush will be in 2020.
Okay, there's our target right there. All right.
Yeah. All right.
Start. All right. Thanks to everyone for listening. And Christine and I will be back on Wednesday.
Take care.